This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Michael Ratner and Michael Smith discuss a number of developments, including the Schumer-Mukasey update.
This is the guy who loves waterboarding like some people love their own partners.
Recently, the founder and first principal of the newly founded Khalil Gibran International Academy was ousted over statements she made that had nothing to do with her job.
This is a real outrage. We have some 60 schools in this city that teach various languages and culture. The first school that decided to teach the Arabic language, they kicked out the principal, who is well-loved in the entire community, not just the Arab community.
We'll also talk with Marcus Redeker about his new book titled The Slave Ship, A Human History.
I'm halfway through it. Beautifully written book. I think really fundamental for understanding of how the American capitalist economy got itself off the ground.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Michael, I know you've been following the Mukasey case, the judge who says he doesn't know what waterboarding is, but if it's good, bad, I don't know. All he knows is that the strong executive is good. What's the update on that?
It was an extremely sad moment in the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee on November 6th, Tuesday, voted to report out the nomination of Michael Mukasey, to the full Senate, where the vote was 11-9. Two of the Democrats joined the Republicans to report out Mukasey. Had those two, Senator Schumer and Feinstein, voted with the other Democrats, Mukasey would have gone down. For me, and I think for all of us who care at all about torture, it was one of the sadder days since 9/11, because here you had an attorney general nominee who first lied and said he didn't know what waterboarding is, simulated drowning, which most people who are knowledgeable on this issue know something about. And secondly, when he did find out what it was, supposedly, he said, well, I can't decide. If it's torture, it's no good. Well, everybody knows it's torture. It's been used since the 15th century. I just read a short history, actually, about how the U.S. used it in the Philippines.
The guy that used it, this American Army guy that used it against a Filipino, was prosecuted for it.
Right. It happened in the so-called, the first really imperialist expansion outside our borders, when the U.S. was going against Spain to take over its colonies, including the Philippines, and they routinely used waterboarding, actually, in the Philippines, also called water torture or the water cure or whatever they call it.
Well, they bring somebody to the brink of death. By people who have survived it, they say it's the most horrible thing that's ever happened to them, to the brink of death. Mukasey says, I don't know.
In the Philippines, I read a number that said something like 100 and some people were waterboarded and only actually 26 survived. There was an anti-imperialist movement in this period that actually called itself an anti-imperialist movement. It was made up of a lot of, you know, people he would not necessarily expect, although I guess you would expect Mark Twain to be an anti-imperialist. Twain actually wrote something on waterboarding, and he said, the torturing of Filipinos by the awful, quote, water cure, for instance, to make them confess. And then Twain goes on, confess what? Truth or lies? How can one know which it is they are telling? For under unendurable pain, a man confesses anything that is required of him, true or false, and his evidence is worthless. And yet upon such evidence, American officers, speaking of those in the Philippines, have actually, and he says, you know about, basically committed atrocities.
That great man that we interviewed months ago, Henri Alleg, who himself was waterboarded by the French soldiers in Algeria, said, it's not a question of doing this to people to elicit some kind of truth from them. It's a question of psychology and power. They do it because they can get away with it, and they do it to terrorize a colonial people. It's essentially activity of those in power in a dying empire.
So let's go back to the vote in the Judiciary Committee. 11-9, Mukasey's reported out despite waterboarding. And, of course, waterboarding, as we've pointed out on this program, is not the only issue that was there in front of that committee. Judge Mukasey is in favor of special trials for terrorists, hates the National Library Association because it's opposed to the Patriot Act, and actually upheld the designation of enemy combatant in his courtroom when he was a judge.
All these are of a piece with his overall notion of going along with the conception of a unitary executive, of an all-powerful executive. The hell with checks and balances, that's gone overboard now. We have Bush. He can pick his judges. He can set up military tribunals. He can say what laws he's going to work on and what laws he's not going to uphold with his signing statements. You got a unitary executive. That's Mukasey. He's on board for that.
And the Democrats, as we've pointed out many times, have essentially been the handmaidens of the executive power and the torture program in the United States.
Well, you can see him enabling the Mukasey vote because the Democrats not only nominated him, Schumer nominated him. He's a pal of Schumer's.
Not a good day for America. Not a good day for the people who undergo torture. There's two other, actually, updates we want to bring you that are related to the torture issue. One is, on the same day, November 6th, when we heard about the Schumer-Feinstein essential sellout on Mukasey, the Center for Constitutional Rights got some good news, which is one of our cases that we filed, a case against CACI, C-A-C-I. CACI is one of the private interrogation companies contracted by the United States to do interrogations in Iraq, and particularly did them in Abu Ghraib. And some of the reports that came out on them said they were involved in the torture of people in Iraq. The question of how you get accountability for torture in Iraq or Guantanamo or Afghanistan has been difficult. Most of the lawsuits have basically foundered, the ones directly against Rumsfeld in the United States, the ones directly against high officials. And so the Center for Constitutional Rights did something special here. They decided to go against the private contractor, CACI, a couple of years ago when the Abu Ghraib revelations came out. And lo and behold, yesterday, on the same day that basically torture got supported by our Senate Judiciary Committee, at least one federal judge said a case can proceed against CACI to a jury trial, to the jury to decide CACI's involvement in the, what we call the torture conspiracy program that took place in Iraq. So it's actually a major victory. It's the first slight glimmer that possibly we can begin to hold some people accountable for torture.
Well, how does it affect Blackwater, for example?
I think that's a really good question. If I were Blackwater, I'd be shaking my boots right now. Because the issue here for CACI, the issue that we got through was whether or not they essentially should be treated like U.S. soldiers and therefore immune from these kind of lawsuits, or were they more independent and had their own supervision within CACI? And of course, what the court said was they're more independent. CACI was supervised by its higher officials within CACI, and therefore CACI was not to be treated exactly like a U.S. soldier and could be sued. Blackwater is even, for our purposes, is even a better case because Blackwater was even more independent. In fact, the time the shootings that we're talking about on September 16th, when 17 people were murdered in Iraq, Blackwater wasn't even guarding anybody. There was no supervision by the State Department. It was on their own. Blackwater was supervising itself. So if I were Blackwater at this point, I think it looks bad for them.
We had another victory in the Mukasey case. Tell the listeners about that.
It's a victory of sorts, but it's one that I want people to go to the website and look at because you're going to see something interesting on that. You're going to see a court opinion that actually, after it was issued, the court reissued the opinion and took out about a page of that opinion. But here's what Mukasey's about. Mukasey was a man who supposedly left some kind of two-way radio communication in his room at the Millennium Hotel right near the World Trade Center. That radio supposedly could talk to airplanes. Mukasey was falsely accused of having that radio in his room. He eventually confessed that it was the radio in his room and it belonged to him. It was a false confession. It was a false confession made because his family was threatened with torture in Egypt. He's Egyptian. His family was in Egypt. The case becomes a civil case where he's suing really because of both the torture as well as the fact that they went after him because of this radio in a false way. It goes up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The Second Circuit says the case can proceed and then gives us a description in opinion number one of how Mukasey was threatened by the FBI. Basically, to summarize it, it says, if you don't tell us this is your radio, if you don't admit this is your radio, your family's going to be tortured in Egypt because we're going to tell the Egyptians about what you are and what you've done, and you're going to be tortured. So what's Hegazi faced with?
Well, and torturing his sister.
Right, that's right. And so what they said to him, the FBI would make his brother, quote, live in scrutiny. I think the brother was here. And would make sure that the Egyptian security gives his family hell. And then, according to Hegazi, when the FBI guy is asked about what that means, he says, well, it probably means they're going to torture people because they don't have the same kind of laws in Egypt. Hegazi goes on to say what was in his mind when he gave the false confession about his family would be tortured. So there's about a page in the opinion in which Hegazi is threatened with torture. Really, it's torture of his family, but that's considered torture of Hegazi. You can't threaten someone with having a relative or a friend tortured on the pain of giving a confession. The opinion is issued with that statement in there and with the FBI statement that they tortured Hegazi. And then about an hour afterwards, the circuit issues another opinion. And again, this opinion is, I don't know, it's like how many pages here? It's long. The whole opinion is just 30 pages long. And they take out a page, and the page they take out is the page about how he was threatened by the FBI with torture. Now, they didn't really give a reason. Presumably, if what we've seen in the past, these are like sources and methods. In other words, they never want you to disclose how they torture people because that will tip off Al-Qaeda, supposedly, and Al-Qaeda will know how to resist. So presumably that was taken out because somehow the government thinks it should be classified. So now you have this bizarre thing. Everybody knows what the FBI allegedly said to Hegazi. It's out in the opinion, but the official opinion no longer has it in it. If you want to read what it says, you can go to our website and you can look at the two redacted pages. We'll give you the link to the opinion as well.
Yeah, lawanddisorder.org.
So that's our update for today. There's always more going on, but we don't want to take the whole program with updates. But this is a difficult time in this country and in the world, obviously, particularly considering what the U.S. is doing around the world.
Ousted Arabic school principal Debbie Al-Muntasir plans to sue the city for violating her freedom of speech after reapplying for her position last month as principal of the Khalil Gibran International Academy in Brooklyn. The ousted principal of the city's first public Arabic language school was forced to resign after she was quoted explaining that the word intifada literally means shaking off in Arabic. This was in reference to a controversy arising over a T-shirt that read, Intifada New York City, created and worn by a group called Arab Women Active in the Arts and Media. Al-Muntasir says she was forced out under pressure from Mayor Bloomberg and calls the offense a serious injustice to Arab and Muslim communities of New York City. Joining us today are activists Donna Neville and Mona L. Jeffrey, who were involved in organizing Debbie Al-Muntasir's defense. Welcome, Mona and Donna, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Some of our listeners may not be aware of what has happened at the Khalil Gibran International Academy. Can you give a brief overview?
Well, the school has been under attack since almost the beginning of this year by organizations and individuals who just don't want an Arabic public school in existence, who think that it's going to indoctrinate the students into Islam. New Visions and the Department of Education stood by and did nothing for 6 months leading up to the principal's forced resignation, as the New York Post, The Sun, Fox News slandered the school with accusations that it is going to promote violence, that its curriculum is Islamist, etc.
I understand the founding principal, Debbie Al-Muntasir, was let go over statements that she made about a T-shirt.
She was forced to resign over statements that she made about a T-shirt that she actually had nothing to do with. My organization, Arab Women Active in the Arts and Media, a couple of years ago, produced a T-shirt with the slogan Intifada NYC. Opponents of this school saw the T-shirt at an Arab Heritage Park Festival this August or July, found that we run one of our programs out of SEBA, the Association for Yemeni Americans, and that the principal serves on the board of that organization. They used that slight connection to criminalize the principal. She was forced by the Department of Education to do an interview with the New York Post. when she was asked about the T-shirt and the organization, she told them what it was really about. You know, Intifada NYC is a call for empowerment. Intifada literally means shaking off. So as an organization made up of women of color, Muslim women, Arab women, we are shaking off the silencing that we feel from the mass media. And about the organization, you know, she simply described our organization, what we do. We work with young women and girls in a community building capacity and as a media organization.
And so for a mere explanation of something that had nothing to do with her governance of this new academy, she was forced out.
Right. She was forced out because she did not condemn. She did not condemn our organization or the T-shirt, and we applaud her for that. She's got principle.
And what did the Department of Education, what was their role in all of this?
Well, for one thing, like I said, they stood by and did nothing as the school was smeared. The logical thing to do when a DOE public school is being accused of these things, and
that's Department of Education, DOE.
Now, you know, violence, Islamicization, etc., the logical thing to do would be for the administration to step forward and say, actually, no, this school is not teaching an Islamist curricula. That's illegal. You know, this is a public school, a non-religious school, and we're not going to stand by and let you, you know, endanger this whole community like this, claiming that these kids are walking into this school and learning how to ultimately be terrorists or be pro-terrorist.
And just to clarify, the curriculum at the school covers the subjects that are covered in other New York City public schools to a certain extent?
Right, and the curriculum is available online on the DOE portal. One of the claims of the opponents is that all of this is covered up, that we can't see the curriculum, we can't see what's going on inside the school, and that something's not right. Just go online onto the DOE website. The curriculum is there.
Ms. Al-Muntasir has great support among a variety of communities. Can you explain a little bit about what her supporters have been doing?
Well, it's actually ironic that Debbie Al-Muntasir is the one who's found herself at the receiving end of this attack, because she's devoted her whole adult life to building bridges between Arab and Muslim communities and other communities. She is a multiculturalist, and that's part of the reason why so many communities have come together in her defense. Jewish communities, communities of color, immigrant communities, everybody, anybody who knows Debbie, even officials like Marty Markowitz have stood up and said, this is ridiculous. We know this woman. We know this woman is anti-violent. She's all about conflict resolution and community building.
I saw both you, Mona, and you, Donna, at the Jews for Racial and Economic Justice event 2 weeks ago. Debbie was one of the honorees there. And I was very moved to read in the program a statement by a fellow who identified himself as Jewish, saying how ashamed he felt that Debbie was attacked in the way she was attacked. And I wanted to get your reaction on that.
Yes, I think one of the reasons so many communities have come out, and also there has been a large response from the Jewish community, from people from all walks of life within the Jewish community, is really to say they did not speak in our name. And Daniel Pipes and the other right-wingers who are there, and then the Sun and the Post, they absolutely do not represent our views as a Jewish community, and certainly do not represent the other communities in New York City. And one of the most shameful things about all this is it really, as Mona was saying, it could have been over. The DOE could have gotten up and had some integrity and said, we will not stand for this. We will not let this right-wing racist, these groups, dictate educational policy. And we stand behind her. And it would have been over. But the DOE, New Visions, the mayor, and then UFT President Randy Weingarten said, maybe, perhaps she shouldn't even be principal. And it was those statements from our officials that really made it impossible for her to continue in her role. And of course, you know, they're saying she resigned, but she was forced to resign. They told her that if she did not resign, the school would not open. And she was passionately committed and has been to the creation and development of this school.
It seems to me that this outrage is just the latest of kind of anti-Arab racist blows that the community has been dealt since 9/11.
Yeah, since September 11th, I mean, this has been, we're living in a culture of surveillance. the New York Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in 2004 found that the surveillance measures that have been taken in New York have curtailed the civil rights of targeted groups like Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians. Meanwhile, Cornell University did a study and found that over half of those polled thought that the civil liberties of Muslims should be curtailed. Now, for a sixth grader walking into school or a parent walking their kid to school, what does this mean on the ground? The young women that I work with in OM all face, you know, stereotyping, you know, hateful encounters on the street from strangers on a regular basis. So that's the context that this is happening. Now, who are these people who are so anti-Arab and anti-Muslim? Some of them are white supremacists, like David Yerushalmi, who's a Jewish white supremacist, who, you know, talks about the intellectual genetic superiority of white men. And this is why our founding fathers didn't give blacks and women the right to vote. Others, like Daniel Pipes, who's a columnist and blogger, etc.
Just got a column in the New York Times.
This man speaks about the enfranchisement of the Muslim American community and how he thinks that that could cause problems for the Jewish American community. And that's exactly what this is. This is the enfranchisement of a community, just like in Little Rock, Arkansas. It's about our opportunity to have education and to have an institution in our communities where we can really take leadership and learn.
Also, in speaking about education, this really is just part of a pattern that's happening in our public education system today. In New York City, we have one of the most discriminatory public education systems and inequitable systems in the country. And I'm part of a center called the Center for Immigrant Families. I'm one of the representatives to the coalition from the center. And we're committed to issues of racial justice, immigrant rights, and one of our main issues is public education. And we have seen repeatedly how communities of color, low-income communities are being marginalized. Schools like Khalil Gibran and others that should be celebrated and honored for serving all our children in New York City rather than just some are instead being under attack. And so it's really part of that larger struggle, too, for public education in our city that reflects our communities.
Are there other schools around the city that are created to provide support for a certain community?
This is part of a larger movement of schools that are multilingual, multicultural. There are over 60 dual language programs in New York City with several different languages, and there are theme-based schools throughout the city. It's part of the small school movement. Of course, you know, as we know, the problem with this school was because the language was Arabic, and that's what it's about.
We've seen this with other schools as well. We've seen the Hetrick Martin Institute in Manhattan under attack because it provides opportunities for LGBT youth. We've seen just recently a couple of schools in California under attack because of the space they provided for immigrant youth and young people of color.
Many educators have told us, principals, teachers, that what's happened to Debbie has created a climate of fear and intimidation throughout the education world. You try to do anything creative, innovative. If you don't say the right thing, if you don't toe the DOE line, then you'll be gotten rid of. And it's very frightening what's happening and what message this sends.
Mona and Donna, tell us about what this school is like and what they wanted to accomplish at the school.
Well, this school approaches Arabic culture and language from a multicultural perspective. So while it teaches students about many cultures, the main culture that students will be learning a lot about is Arabic culture. Like I said, it's confused with Islam. First of all, the press and the opponents of the school have taken advantage of what they hope is the ignorance of the public, that we don't know the difference between Islam and Arabic. Arabic is a language. Islam is a religion. There's nothing wrong with Islam, but it's separate from the Arabic language. And anyone who says that you can't teach the Arabic language outside of a religious context is completely bogus. We saw on campuses across the country recently Islamofascism Week. A whole week dedicated to raising awareness of the ills of Islam / Arabs / all of them, because they're all the same. So in campuses like Columbia University, we saw people like David Horowitz speaking. You know, basically, this is hate speech. And campuses in California, these people were booed off the stage. We attended a protest with some students at Columbia University, And it's just amazing to know that our university system engenders this sort of thinking, and at the same time doesn't allow the free thought of others like Rashid Khalidi, Nadia Abulhaj, and the many academics and thinkers who have been attacked for speaking positively of Palestine or speaking negatively of Israeli policy.
And you were asking about the curriculum in the school. Debbie Almentasser recently made her first public statement at a press conference telling the community what really happened because she had been threatened and couldn't speak out for a period of time. And in that statement, she said, and I quote her, "I was thrilled to create a unique school that would provide a rigorous region-based curriculum with Arabic language and cultural studies, and that would equip students for work in such areas as international affairs, diplomacy, and cross-cultural understanding."
Since she's been effectively ousted, who is in charge of the Leadership Academy right now?
They have appointed another interim acting principal in Debbie's place. Right now, the process for applications to that position is in progress. In an interview with the New York Post a few weeks ago, a Department of Education spokesperson said that Debbie's welcome to apply to the job. She'll be treated like any other applicant. However, when she did move forward with applying, she was told that her application would not be considered. So right now, we, along with the principals union and a broad-based community, are calling on the DOE to consider her application, first and foremost. Secondly, reinstate her. Right the wrong that you've committed.
Is there any legal action pending?
Yes, there is. There's a lawsuit that's in progress, and it's based on the violation of her First Amendment rights. She was fired because the DOE found what she said to be unacceptable. They disagreed with what she said about the T-shirts. Of course, we know her response was the response of a thoughtful educator, and so it will be challenged legally.
So let me understand it. These up to 60 other schools have a focus on language and culture, as well as a pretty traditional curriculum in terms of other courses.
Exactly. My children actually went to a dual language program where Spanish was the language, and what it really is, you learn in both languages. Khalil Gibran at this point doesn't have a full dual language program because it was beginning with some hours of Arabic and then it was going to build as the school developed. Right now it was opening with sixth grade. It's going to be sixth through 12th grade. And so it was beginning with a sixth grade class. And the school has a number of Arab language speakers who speak Arabic as their first language. And then there's also about 80% of the school is from the African American community. And so the school really reflects New York City and is open. And people are encouraged to come from all communities and all backgrounds.
It sounds wonderful.
We've been told by, you know, education specialists and principals that to remove a principal from a brand new school just 3 weeks before opening day, it's going to put the school in a difficult situation. We really want what's best for the school. Debbie wants what's best for the school. We want the school to succeed, you know, with the vision and, you know, that it was started with.
And all this publicity can't really have a positive effect on the children who go there and their families.
For full disclosure, Donna is related to the attorney, an old friend of ours and a wonderful civil rights attorney, Alan Levine. And we'll bring you updates on this lawsuit because this is something that we want to get behind. Donna and Mona, give us the name of your organization that's supporting Debbie and give us your website so we can link ours to yours.
You could find us at kgia.wordpress.com.
Say that again.
www.kgia.wordpress.com. And we are working with communities in support of the Khalil Gibran International Academy. If you go to the website, you could sign on to our statement and get involved in our upcoming action.
And what's the name of your organization?
I work with Arab Women Active in the Arts and Media.
And Donna?
I'm part of Center for Immigrant Families, and both our organizations are part of the coalition communities in support of the Khalil Gibran International Academy. On a personal note, I just wanted to say when I first got involved with this issue and CIF got involved with this issue, we did it because when we heard about it, just connected to everything that we're passionate about and committed to. And I didn't know Debbie. But after meeting her, I have to say I didn't think it was possible to deepen my commitment, but it's happened. She so exemplifies everything we could want and hope for, and the kind of goal we're trying to create for our children, the kind of society we're trying to create. And we talk about this at the Coalition a lot, that we've come together, groups from such different communities, and we're working so respectfully together and really doing so many things. And I think it's just a reflection of what Debbie has helped build and create in our city. And for this to be happening to her is... You know, it's. I was just going to say it's a Shonda, but it's really.
Well, we here on Law and Disorder are looking forward to the day, and hopefully the day very soon, when we have Debbie on as a guest to celebrate her reinstatement, and I hope that happens soon. Thank you so much, both of you, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Mona. Thanks, Donna. Pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we talk with author and award-winning historian Marcus Redeker about his recent book, Slave Ship. Marcus has scoured through letters, diaries, memoirs, captain's logbooks, and shipping company records to piece together the intimate realities of these 18th-century sailing vessel carrying enslaved Africans. Redeker draws startling parallels to global economy structures then and now, tracing back as New England timber was used to build slave ships, yet nails and ropes were purchased from Liverpool at discounts, ship captain stock options, and more. In his book, Marcus also documents revolts among underpaid sailors and the solidarity that evolves amid slaves and servants. One review describes Slave Ship as, quote, a tale of tragedy and terror, but also an epic of resilience, survival, and the creation of something entirely new. Marcus Redeker restores the slave ship to its rightful place alongside the plantation as a formative institution of slavery, a place where a profound and still haunting history of race, class, and modern economy was made. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Marcus.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Marcus, why don't we start, in some sense, when I looked at the pervasiveness of the slave trade, how many years it went on, how many human beings it affected directly and indirectly, and just give us sort of a description of that.
Sure. The slave trade, I think, is one of the most important long-term events in the making of the modern world. It lasted almost 400 years, beginning around 1500. The last slaving voyages were in the 1860s or so. So we're looking at a very long span of time in which somewhere between 12 and 15 million people were loaded onto the slave ships, and something between 10 and 11 or maybe more million unloaded alive at the end of the Middle Passage, as it was called. That would mean that approximately 15% died along the way. I guess what I would emphasize about the slave ship is that it was one of the two most important institutions in the making of the modern Atlantic slave system. The people who worked on the plantation systems, Virginia, South Carolina, Jamaica, Barbados, Brazil, produced the greatest planned accumulation of wealth the world had yet seen. And without these slave ships, none of it would have happened.
You're talking about the plantations in both the Caribbean and in North America, is that right?
That's correct.
And when you say the greatest accumulation of wealth, I mean, does that accumulation, and I'll jump forward a little bit, have any effect on, when you say the modern world, have any effect today on what we have in this country, et cetera?
Well, this is a matter that's much debated among historians, and so the precise nature of the contribution of the slave system to, for example, industrialization is still in dispute. But I think it's without a doubt true that Britain and the United States saw the slave systems as central to their power, both their national power and their imperial power, that the wealth the plantation system produced were major parts of the wealth of each nation. And in truth, we still live with the effects of all this. The slave system and the racism that was its necessary correlate are very much alive today.
When we think about the slave trade, we all, at least I certainly, before I read your book and some other material, didn't look at it as necessarily a respectable profession or one that was really integrated into the government and the structure. I think I was wrong.
Yes, the slave trade actually could never have risen to the levels it reached without direct governmental involvement. All of the early slave trades, whether Portuguese, Dutch, British, French, the governments were involved in setting those up because they were capital intensive. It required the building of fortresses and trading posts on the coast of Africa. It was a very expensive business, so that the slave trade itself, the European involvement in it, was very much directed towards maximizing the wealth of the nation. Now, at a certain point, private trade took over. This happened sooner in Britain than in other places. And it continued, but it continued with government support even after that point in time. So it's a massive business, and it's really crucial to the rise of the Atlantic world as we know it.
And people were looked at with respect. I mean, there were people in churches and in government. I mean, this is not something that, from what I've read in your book, that people were looked down on or shunned or looked at as pirates. This was really part and parcel of the society, from what I get.
Without question. You see, the fact that we tend to look back with abolitionist eyes at all this is a sign of how we've fundamentally reevaluated the place of slavery in the world, although the persistence of modern slavery in our current times might cause us to question even that judgment. And maybe we'll come back to that later in our discussion. But it's true that in the 17th and 18th century, slave traders rose to the highest level of government. These were gentlemen of the loftiest standing. John Newton, the slave trade captain who later in life wrote the hymn Amazing Grace, regarded his position on the slave ship as a godly calling. So it certainly was viewed very broadly as a respectable kind of undertaking. Now, this wouldn't have been true if you looked at it from below in terms of the enslaved and the sailors who made these ships go. They had a rather different view.
You might want to describe actually what a voyage was like for our listeners.
Michael, the first thing that I must say is that it almost defies language to describe the horrors of the slave ship. And I'll just begin by saying that you have literally hundreds of Africans, multi-ethnic Africans, loaded onto these vessels, these tall ships, these sailing ships. They're jammed into a lower deck in very close quarters, and they're basically terrorized by the crew, the officer, and the captain. That terror is explicitly the way in which slave ships were ruled. People were just terrified most of the time. There were whips, there were chains. This is a floating dungeon, as one sailor called it. It's a floating dungeon, the slave ship.
And you point out that the terror came from the captain down to the crew and then down to the slaves. So was that kind of a totalitarian system, say, that the Nazis perfected in their concentration camps?
I think it's a very interesting comparison because the ship, even non-slave ships, they were quite totalitarian environments in which the authority of the captain was unchecked. The captain had the power to do most anything he wanted, including, in many instances, beat a member of the crew to death. And then, on a slave ship, you have the most extreme version of this same thing, of this phenomenon, of a person who is so powerful that it almost defies belief. There's an instance I talk about in the book in which one ship captain is pushing off from the dock. His vessel is beginning to sail, and he kind of mutters under his breath, "Now I have a hell of my own." And what he meant was that he would be Lucifer, and he would inflict torment and suffering on anyone he chose. And that is what slave trading captains did.
Marcus Rediker has written a very fine, beautifully written book, The Slave Ship, A Human History.
I believe that we have to understand concretely what happened on these ships, that we sometimes take comfort in abstraction, talking merely about the numbers. I want to talk about the ship as a framework for human interaction, or inhuman interaction, as the case may be. So one of the things that made a tremendous impression on anyone who went aboard a slave ship was the smell of it. Now, you have people who are sick, people who are seasick, people who are vomiting, and also there's the smell that comes from the human body when people are afraid. It was said in Charleston, South Carolina, that when the wind was blowing off the water a certain way, you could actually smell a slave ship before you could see it. So the smells of the slave ship are important to understand. The sounds of the slave ship, people singing, the crack of the whip, the timbers groaning, very important to try to make this real. And I found that as I did this, I was in fact replicating a strategy that was taken by abolitionists, the people who opposed the slave trade in the 18th century, who said that the best way for us to get everyone to agree to abolish the trade is just describe what happens, make it real to people. And that's one of the goals of the book.
What happened on arrival in the New World, or when the slaves reached port?
Well, after a long ocean passage, usually somewhere between 7 and 13 weeks, and I should add that many people had been on the ship much longer because it took an average of 6 months on the coast of Africa to gather a human cargo. People will have suffered this misery for a very long period. Then they would arrive in, let's say, the Chesapeake in Virginia, Charleston, or Kingston, Jamaica, and the bodies of the enslaved would be cleaned up as they're prepared for sale. These sales happen in various ways, but essentially at that moment in time, people would be brought ashore and the planters would buy them and then transport them to their plantations where they would set them to work.
Now, you know, looking back, as you said, you know, from an abolitionist point of view, it's just completely inhuman. And the question I've always had for myself is, how did it take 400 years to stop it? I mean, where was the morality? Where was the church? How could this have continued? And then we can always get to how it's still continuing in modern times, but how could this have continued for 400 years as part of really what we considered, I mean, many considered probably a Western civilized system?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first answer to that question, Michael, is that it continued because it was so profitable. It was a matter of great importance, as we've said, to governments to support the slave trade. What happened was legal. I know that your listeners are especially interested in questions of law. The slave trade, including the captain's extreme powers, even over life and death, all this was perfectly legal. It went on for a very long time because so many powerful people profited from it. Now, there were always critics of the trade. If you go back even into the 16th and 17th century, there are people who were speaking against it, who were speaking against the institution of slavery, but they are marginal to power. What happened in the 1780s was that a social movement was organized, a movement, really quite a diverse movement, with all kinds of people involved, former slaves, sailors, middle-class types, even the occasional upper-class person like William Wilberforce. And this movement essentially connected a great deal of pre-existing antipathy to the slave trade and very quickly had a national agreement that it should be abolished because they were able to show that it was horrible and what happened on those slave ships was indefensible.
Let me ask a question about that, and this is one that I know has come up before in discussing the abolition of the slave trade in England in particular, is... Yes, it did happen in the 1780s, and I think our listeners and a lot of others are familiar with, in some way, with that movement. But was there an economic basis for that happening at that time? Was there a reason it took hold? Was it possibly getting less profitable? Was there something going on with England and other countries? I actually don't know. I just heard rumors of this.
Let me put the question in a different way. Is wage slavery at that point more profitable for the capitalists than owning somebody outright?
This is a very good question, and this is what I referred to indirectly when I said the matter continues to be debated. For the longest time, we thought that West Indian slavery was becoming less profitable and that abolition was simply an acknowledgement of that economic imperative. But recent research, including work by my colleague Seymour Drescher, has shown that West Indian slavery remained profitable really right up to the time of the abolition of the slave trade and even the abolition of slavery itself. So I think now what we're inclined to do is to emphasize that it really was a social movement which brought it to an end in the face of great and powerful interests. We have to remember the sugar planters who...
I just want to say that's really interesting to hear, and it's a powerful message for people to hear, because it doesn't mean that what we're faced with, whether today or yesterday or tomorrow, is inevitable just because it's owned, makes money.
It's a classic example of what began as a very small movement, rose up and sort of connected the dots, linked together people with many different kinds of dissatisfaction and moral outrage, brought them together in a national movement which then defeated one of the most powerful groups in the world, the sugar planters, who had great political power in Parliament. We have to acknowledge that this was not, even as this movie Amazing Grace would have you believe, this was not an aristocratic gift of grace from the upper class. It was people like Alauda Equiano, the Igbo slave turned sailor who wrote a literary account of the slave trade and his experience of the slave system. He made a major contribution to this. Common sailors educated the middle and upper class abolitionists about what was happening on board these ships.
The Quakers.
Yes, Quakers played a major role in it. This is a big part of American history. One of the Quakers I found was himself a captain of a slave ship and who later joined the Quaker order and became an outspoken abolitionist. So the circulation of the experience of the ships throughout society was a major part of the success of the movement.
Marcus, there's one set of comparisons I think you draw in the book around the way business was done during the slave trade, deregulation, bonuses, the way business is done today. Can you just draw that out for our listeners?
Well, one way to think about this is to understand that the slave trade was an international corporate endeavor. As such, it had to be able to conduct business beyond national boundaries. Slave ship captains were, in a sense, multicultural merchants. They functioned on a commission system. They got privileged slaves. The profits could be extraordinarily high, and the human suffering that was part of all this was basically hidden. Merchants, I've suggested, hid it from themselves by using kind of abstract calculations of labor and profits and all the rest, and refused actually to see this business in human terms. I think that continues directly into the present, where we still have, I think, rather inhuman ways of thinking about society and the human consequences of profit-making.
Let's jump ahead a little bit to modern-day slavery. I mean, you mentioned it briefly, but do you have some thoughts about the pervasiveness of it, or how we look at it today, how it compares to what happened during these 400-year period that you discuss in the book?
Well, in this case, Michael, I would recommend the work of Kevin Bales, who a sociologist who has written a very interesting book called Disposable People about the resurgence of slavery in the modern economy. He suggests a number of 35 to 40 million people effectively enslaved today, and by that he means people who were held in degrading work by the threat or actuality of violence. And this might be sex slaves in Thailand or agrarian slaves in Brazil, child slaves in Pakistan. There are many different possibilities here, many different instances of it, I should say. So given this, we have to resist the idea that all people who were good and moral rose up in the 19th century and put an end to slavery. It didn't happen that way. It is true that the international economic system was transformed as wage labor came to replace slave labor, but effective enslavement continued and continues down to the present.
Because we talked about Newton and Amazing Grace, the song, and I know I read in Adam Hochschild's book something about it. And it's the question that I always tell my children, well, you know, Amazing Grace was written by a former slave ship owner, trader, and it was written because he actually, you know, felt bad about what he had done as a slave trader. And then I read, well, no, it was really a religious song about him finding God, nothing to do with the slave trade. You have an opinion, or do you have a truth to this?
Well, there's a myth out there about John Newton and Amazing Grace, and it goes something like this. John Newton was working in this ungodly trade, the slave trade. He had a revelation from God. He converted to Christianity. He wrote Amazing Grace as penance, and then that's that. Well, the reality is somewhat different. John Newton had his Christian conversion while he was working as a first mate on a slaving voyage, and then he went three more voyages as the captain of a slave ship. He never actually made a decision to leave the slave trade. He had a stroke, which required him to retire from the sea. And then 19 years later, he wrote Amazing Grace. And then 14 years after that, he made his first public condemnation of the slave trade. Now, when he did finally speak out against it, he was a very effective witness because he said, I'm a sinner, I've seen the error of my ways, and I repent and I condemn this trade. But he certainly didn't feel that way when he was in the trade. In fact, I have correspondence in which he's writing to someone, well, you know, I once was lost, but now I have a godly calling as captain of a slave ship, and now I'm truly found.
Yeah, well, now I can see.
So I've lied to my children for like a number of years here.
We've read Bury the Chains, Adam Hochschild's book on this. In reading the book, I keep thinking, come on, John Newton, help out some more. He did speak out here and there, but he really wasn't in the vanguard of the anti-slavery movement after his conversion, was he?
No, he wasn't. In fact, I've suggested in this book that the vanguard of the anti-slavery movement is happening as the enslaved Africans resist on board the ships.
Exactly.
This is the front line of the battle. This is really crucial. It inspires the abolitionists because it's very clear that the enslaved themselves do not accept this, do not accept the slave ship, do not accept the slave system, and their resistance sets all kinds of other resistance in motion. And I might add, because I think it might be of interest to your readers, that I actually began to think about writing this book when I was visiting people on death row in Pennsylvania. I began to think about that situation on death row as a modern system of terror. I was meeting especially with Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row in Pennsylvania. I kind of wanted to understand the background of both the terror and the racial disparity that we find on death row. And believing, as I do, that the movement against the death penalty must work closely with people who are on death row, I found it significant that the abolitionists in the 18th century were working with sailors and the enslaved as they tried to publicize what was actually going on.
Marcus Rediker, author of The Slave Ship, A Human History. And Marcus, really, thank you. This book is a really important contribution and a shocking one, I think, for all our listeners to have heard about.
Marcus, thank you very much. It's just an elegantly written book. The Slave Ship, A Human History by Marcus Rediker. It came out by Viking Books just a little while ago. And it's really been a pleasure and an honor to talk with you about your book. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Last week, November 7th, was the 90th anniversary of what was the central event around which the 20th century turned. I'm speaking, of course, of the Great Russian Revolution. A listener of ours from Colorado sent in two quotes, one from Eugene V. Debs, the trade unionist and one-time socialist candidate for president, and Rosa Luxemburg, the socialist European leader, reflecting on the Russian Revolution, and then he himself reflected on what it's meant for us 90 years later. And we'd like to share with you the quotes from Debs and from Luxemburg. Debs gave this speech in Canton, Ohio in 1918. It was to send him to prison for many years. It was a speech against the war, a speech in support of the Russian Revolution. In fact, he ran for president from prison. There was a great button with a picture of Debs and his cell number. And Debs said this,
Yes, my comrades, my heart is attuned to yours. Aye, all our hearts now throb as one great heart responsive to the battle cry of the social revolution. Here, in this alert and inspiring assemblage, our hearts are with the Bolsheviki of Russia. Those heroic men and women, those incomparable comrades, have by their incomparable valor and sacrifice added fresh luster to the fame of the international movement. Those Russian comrades of ours have made greater sacrifices, have suffered more, and have shed more heroic blood than any like number of men and women anywhere on earth. They have laid the foundation of the first real democracy that ever drew the breath of life in this world. That was Debs in 1918 in the famous Canton, Ohio anti-war speech. In that same year, Rosa Luxemburg said, "The Bolshevik October uprising was not only the actual salvation of the Russian Revolution, it was also the salvation of the honor of international socialism." Our listener and friend Lee wrote the following to us. 90 years later, the assessments of Debs and Luxemburg of the 1917 October Revolution, like all of the grandly optimistic assessments made at the time by those whose hearts and minds and very lives were bound to the struggle for emancipation of the exploited toiling classes, evokes a mixture of longing and regret as one casts his or her eyes back over the bloody intervening decades of sacrifice, defeat, and betrayal, and contemplates the present moment of aggressive reaction. But from those who understand that no matter how often and terribly it has been beaten and betrayed, the banner of socialism yet remains the single hope for a decent future for humanity. What the world needs is not wistful longing, nor regret, nor certainly despair. To borrow from the subtitle of Susan Weissman's biography of Victor Serge, we must set our course on hope. On this anniversary of that oh-so-hopeful day 90 years ago, let us raise a glass and toast the heroism and optimism of our socialist forebears, and seek in the deadly contradictions that today rack a dying system and torture and endanger the whole human race the realistic basis for our hope that the triumph of justice and joy over exploitation and misery remains possible. Hasta Victoria siempre, Lee.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Banjo player Eli Smith.